If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us on the New Books Network's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery channel. I'm Steve Beitler. My guest today has written an important book on America's longest war, The War on Drugs. Earlier this year, Reaction Books published Opium's Orphans, the 200-year history of the War on Drugs by Pierre Caquet. Pierre, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks to the New Books Network for organizing this podcast and providing me with the opportunity to speak on the subject, which is an important subject to me.
Pierre is an associate at Hughes Hall at the University of Cambridge. His research focuses on the intersection of international relations and culture, ideology, religion, and social issues. His two earlier books have examined the impact of ideas and beliefs on global events. For many Americans and others, the phrase war on drugs brings to mind two things. First is President Richard Nixon's declaration of the war in 1971. Second are images of law enforcement people in front of huge stacks of illegal drugs, promising that this drugs haul would make a real dent in the illicit trade. Pierre's new book puts these images into a challenging historical framework. It shows, for example, how the drug war was about 150 years old when Richard Nixon made his declaration. Opium's Orphans locates the true roots of the drug war in China and India, and the British Empire's aspirations for both. It shows how policies based on the properties of opium have been applied over two centuries to disparate substances. In addition, it describes how a global effort, long led by the United States, to eliminate drugs at their sources has had unplanned consequences, economic, political, and social, while falling far short of its stated goals. This is a complex story, with many actors and lots of twists and turns. We're fortunate to have a superb guide to help us through this history. Pierre, let's start at the beginning. How did you come to write Opium's Orphans?
Well, quite simply, it's a book on a big topic that hasn't been covered before. The idea came out of earlier research interests, and as usual, there's always a little bit of serendipity to it. But I soon realized that it just hadn't been covered properly, and for this for various reasons. As you said yourself, people just commonly assume that the war on drugs is either something that began with Richard Nixon, or if it began before that, has been an American led exercise, if not a purely American exercise. And that just isn't the case. The war on drugs began, was from the very beginning, was an international exercise. It did benefit, if that's the right word, from significant American input. But drug prohibition comes from international treaties, international conditions, and domestic legislations, including in the U.S., have followed from these treaties, not the other way around. There's a misconception there, which in turn affects our vision of what I call the long war on drugs, how we've come up with the present anti-narcotics order. Second, so why hasn't that the subject been treated to date? Part of it is because for historians, this is relatively recent discipline. Researching drugs and drug legislation has only been something that's interested historians for the last 30, 40 years at the very most. And so we've had histories looking at domestic conditions. We've had histories looking at international settings over limited time periods, and they're all extremely valuable and interesting, but nobody's really looked at the global picture over a sufficiently long period of time, in my opinion. And that, doing that, alters our view of the war on drugs and the current system that we have today, narcotics prohibition. And then finally, I mean, the last thing is obviously it's an acutely relevant topic, particularly in the U.S. with the appalling opioid epidemic, which has had an incredibly tragic death toll and is still going on, amazingly. And that's tightly connected to the war on drugs, in my opinion. So in a nutshell, that's, you know, how I came to the topic. I came to it originally tangentially, as historians often do. But then I really felt pulled and sucked into it, if you like.
And we'll get back to the connection with the opiate epidemic in a few minutes. But I wanted to circle back and ask you, is there a key theme or a takeaway from the book that you would want readers to leave the book having understood or learned?
Yes, absolutely there is. And I'm glad you mentioned that it is a convoluted story. It is a convoluted story, as all 200-year histories are, but at the end of the day, there is a simple takeaway, which is that drug prohibition, or the anti-narcotics system that we have today, was not built on scientific premises, but on political premises, and is the result of a particular and in many ways unpredictable and accidental political and international process. And that has, of course, all sorts of implications, because the system we have was built on a number of treaties and laws deriving from these treaties to regulate the opium trade and the trade in opiates, so derivatives from opium, which are mainly morphine and heroin. Of course, there are more, especially now, but we are talking about opium originally, accessorily morphine and heroin. And so we have this system that's built on treaties and laws and regulations, an entire approach designed to regulate opiates, which are a particular class of drugs on which other drugs have been just purely tagged along. The first one was cocaine, the second marijuana. And then later on, we've had amphetamines, we've had hallucinogens such as LSD and so on, ecstasy and so on, and so on. But the point is, we have a drug control that tends to treat all drugs like opiates, or we might say we have a drug control system that tends to treat all drugs like heroin. And all drugs aren't heroin. That's the point. But the reason we have that is that our system is the result of a long political process and not a scientific blank slate approach, as you know, people might guess it to be.
So I'm sure that many of our listeners have heard about the opium wars, but may not know a lot about them. Could you talk about the significance of these conflicts as perhaps the opening chapter of the drug war?
Yes, absolutely. That's where the story starts. I hadn't heard I didn't know very much about the opium wars at the beginning either. Apart from the name, it's like, oh yeah, the opium wars. What were they again? So there were two opium wars. They both took place in the 19th century. The background was that China, at the time, the Chinese Empire, had forbidden opium, banned opium as a drug domestically. It was faced with a fast rising population of people who smoked opium, and found that objectionable and dangerous, decided to prohibit opium as a drug in the early 19th century, effectively. The problem was that opium wasn't grown in China, but it was grown in India, which at the time was a British colony. And the British response to Chinese action trying to prevent that opium entering China was to launch a war of imperial aggression. In fact, two wars of imperial aggression. So these were classic imperialist episodes. They were entirely shameful episodes on trumped up excuses. Classic gunboat diplomacy, if you like. The wars took place, the first opium wars dated 1839 to 1842. The second one, 1856 to 1860. Both were won by the imperialists. The first one, the British were alone, and the second one, they were joined by France for reasons that had nothing to do with opium. And the second opium war resulted or led to the legalization of opium imports into China. So in a way, opium was forced, after all, on the Chinese Empire. Now, why does that concern us, you might ask? Concerns us because in the early 20th century, a group of nations, but specifically China, the United States, which had always opposed the opium wars and the opium traffic, and a repentant Britain, decided they should do something about the opium trade. So you had conferences and quickly followed by treaties that arose as an exercise in atonement for the opium wars. And these opium conferences are the basis still today for anti-narcotics internationally, which itself is the basis for domestic anti-narcotics laws around the world, including the United States. I'm happy to elaborate, but the Harrison Act is effectively the big piece of American legislation, anti-drug legislation. It's the first big piece of federal legislation. There were some isolated state actions before that, but this big piece of federal legislation, and it was written in the aftermath of the Hague Conference.
You referred to this earlier, and I wanted to go back a little bit. Early in the book, you talk about the many shades of prohibition. And I'd be curious, Pierre, about a little more detail on that. How would you describe these many shades or flavors, perhaps, of prohibition?
So we can simplify them as a four-level system, if you like. So it could be 4 degrees. One is complete legalization. So it's an environment in which all drugs are permitted, freely available through any sort of retail channel you care to talk about, whether to be used medically or recreationally. So this, in effect, is the system that prevailed in the United States and in most European countries and in Britain, certainly, and in fact, most of the world, up until the early 20th century and in the United States before the Harrison Act. You then have a next level in which you restrict drugs to medical uses. That is still the case for some of the drugs that are identified as narcotics under drug legislation. Morphine, for example. You know, most people in America or Europe are, you know, sadly, are likely to be administered morphine probably once in their lives just because they have an operation or, you know, God forbid, they may have cancer, things like that. So morphine remains an essential medicine, but it's also a regulated drug, which means it's forbidden for recreational purposes. Then you can... So we're talking about here regulation of restriction of drugs to the medical sector so far, but purely through pharma laws, yes, pharmaceutical laws. A lot of other drugs, the pharmaceutical products, not just morphine, are restricted to pharmaceutical sales. You need a prescription to buy them, and you can only buy them through certain regulated retail channels. And then you have health authorities nationally that pay attention to, you know, what goes on with the pharmaceuticals. Obviously, there's FDA approval and so on and so on. But so far, you're only regulating these drugs as pharmaceutical products through your pharma laws. You can then add and this model has been, by the way, historically a model for regulating narcotics, as we call them. So for instance, it was the prevailing model in France and Germany already in the early 20th century. They were these drugs were regulated through as normal pharmaceutical products. They were not allowed for recreational use, but there were no extra penalties in particular compared to other pharmaceutical products. And that's, in fact, the next level. Is you restrict drugs to the medical market, but you add a series of harsher penalties in case people breach the regulations, whether distributors, pharmacists, or people who are not pharmacists or drug dealers, or perhaps even the user. Yes, punish people for possession, add to your pharma laws a set of fines, prison sentences, and so on, and criminal records, and so on and so on. And of course, the fourth level is total prohibition for any use whatsoever, medical or recreational. And that is a level that has, in practice, still remains the case for marijuana under the 1961 Single Convention, which is the big treaty that regulates the trade and use of marijuana and the domestic legislation of marijuana around the world. Yeah, or it's also the case of heroin under the 1961 Single Convention, or in the United States under domestic legislation that was passed earlier. I think it, from memory, 1925 or perhaps 24, something like that. Yeah, so you have these four levels. You have completely free market, total legalization, regulation through pharmaceutical laws, pharma laws plus extra penalties, which is what we see in the Harrison Act. Under the Harrison Act, all the drugs were restricted to the medical sector, but they were still allowed medically. And then you have a complete ban for any use whatsoever, medical or recreational. And of course, there can be shades. Yes, I mean, there are schedules. There are drug schedules, both in the drug treaties and in most domestic drug laws. So there are more shades and of prohibition than you can have. Also, another variation is, do you criminalize use or possession? Do you punish the drug user, or do you only punish traffickers? A big question, a philosophical question also in my view, but a big practical question in terms of drug policies. So to simplify, we have these four levels, and then there are added variations to these four levels of prohibition or legalization.
At one point in the book, you describe as somewhat similar China's opium plague in the late 19th and early 20th century and America's current opioid epidemic. Could you elaborate on that a bit? How are they similar or somewhat parallel?
I was really making a quantitative point there, trying to assess the gravity of the late 19th century Chinese opium epidemic. May sound like a somewhat esoteric point, but it's important because that's the background to the big conferences that started worldwide anti-narcotics legislation, prohibition, effectively. So it is useful to know what was going on or not going on. And in fact, and historians have been very at odds over how extensive that opium plague, as some called it, was or wasn't. So you have some people who've claimed that you had 50 million dreadful opium addicts in China out of a population of 400 million. And you have people who've claimed that it was nothing really. It was all exaggerated by a bunch of Protestant missionaries and everything was totally fine, really. I come out a little bit in the middle in the sense that, first of all, both can't be true. There was either because we do know we don't know how many people smoked opium in China, but we know roughly, or at least at a maximum limit, how much opium was smoked in China around that time. And so either there were 50 million who were opium smokers, and they were light smokers who could not be described as addicts, they were all heavy smokers whose health was ruined and who were tragically addicted, but then they cannot have been more than perhaps a million or two out of a population of 400 million. So that's one point. So I came to the conclusion, to make things a little bit more graspable in terms of how this may have looked to contemporaries, I looked to the American opioid epidemic because it's acute, it's in the news, it's something very dramatic, it's something that people would notice. At the same time, you can't quite say that it's crippling the entire United States, you know, economically or politically, which was some people said about China at the time. So that, hence the analogy that I use. And how it's important to make one big caveat, which is that smoking opium is much less dangerous than injecting heroin, let alone fentanyl or some of the other opioids. So probably in early 20th century China, you saw far fewer deaths, direct deaths from drug addiction, from overdose is what I'm talking about. On the other hand, you probably saw a graver social incidence than impoverished farmers, people selling their children, dying from hunger, or disease, things like that. Because obviously the level of wealth was far, 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 far inferior. And so you would have a very large population living already in very precarious conditions, and obviously it didn't help if they then became opium addicts.
So to what historical factors, given all this, to what historical factors would you attribute what I call America's and other places' amnesia about opium and its risks? We seem to go through these cycles, and it's not just with opium. The same thing has happened in America with cocaine. We go through these cycles. And how would you, to what would you attribute what I call this historical amnesia about opium?
Yes, so when I talk about amnesia, I was thinking of the late 19th century, 20th century conditions in the U.S. under which opiates, we were talking about mostly morphine at the time, there wasn't much heroin, tiny bit of opium, but it wasn't what people would typically take as a drug in the United States around that time, and then some cocaine as well. These products were basically freely distributed. You could buy them at the drugstore pretty much anywhere. They were not legislated on or barely at all. Manufacturers advertise these drugs. So we have kind of crazy looking, actually. They're kind of funny. And, you know, so advertisements for cocaine, you know, as a product for kids, you know, for teething, for example. You give cocaine to your kids so they you know, they don't feel the pain. So that's the context, and there's good reason to believe that there was a tangible population of people who were regular drug takers in the United States, and this population was much higher, for example, than the French or the German population. Which, just as a reminder, did have slightly tighter legislation because you could only procure these drugs through medical channels in France or Germany at the time. And so that's the background. But then all that history all just was completely forgotten or went away when the FDA faithfully approved OxyContin for prescription as a pain medicine in 1995. Why? And so, which was the first step in the absolutely appalling opioid epidemic. Why did that happen? We have pat answer to say, well, people don't know history. But as a historian, I don't want to sound pretentious or condescending. So I forget I said that. But I think more perhaps to the point and importantly, generally with the war on drugs and anti-narcotics legislation, the result of it is that people, and by people I mean everyone, including politicians and legislators, tend to separate entirely the world of recreational drugs, forbidden drugs, narcotics. Yes, narcotics is a quaint term, but I love the term because it really knows what we're talking about. And pharmaceutical products, creating a false sense of comfort and a dangerous illusion. It's completely crazy that the FDA approved OxyContin in 1995. If I were elected American president, the first thing I'd do is fire the lot of them. OxyContin is just morphine in a pill. That's all it is. Why would you approve that as a painkiller for chronic pain? if you're not approving morphine already. It makes no sense. But the complete separation of these two worlds in the legislator's mind and in the regulator's mind creates this full sense of comfort, which is paradoxical because actually all drugs, and it's one of the big themes in the book, are what I called fallen medicines. They all started out as medicines. That's why they are branded narcotics now, unlike alcohol or tobacco, which did not start as medicines. It's the case of marijuana, which was used medically in the 19th century. It was in the American pharmacopoeia and all the European pharmacopoeias. It's the case of cocaine, which had a meteoric campaign as a very useful medicine after it was synthesized for the first time in 1860. For 40 years, it was extremely useful. It was a big step forward for medicine at the time. Of course, the case for morphine. It was the case for heroin, which was invented as a medicine. Amphetamines, even LSD, had a career as a psychiatric medicine. And so, you know, that's where they all come from. And that's how they were all originally banned. It started, well, these medicines aren't so good anymore. We're finding side effects. We think they're addictive. People are using them out for non-medical uses. So let's restrict them to medical use and let's add penalties to it, which there you have. The definition of what becomes a narcotic, you know, how a pharmaceutical product becomes a narcotic. But if you're going to do that, it's completely absurd then to start approving what are really narcotics as widely prescribed and advertised, indeed, drugs. It makes no sense.
I want to take a little bit of a different tack with my next question. Thomas De Quincey's Confessions of an Opium Eater is a well-known literary landmark published in 1822. How would you assess its significance in the perception of opium and the history of the drug war?
Okay, there are two ways to there are two responses to that, depending on significant to whom. De Quincey's work is significant and is very useful to historians as a marker of widely held attitudes to drugs at the time in Europe or indeed in the United States, because there's no reason to think that attitudes were different there. The work provides a clue that people were somewhat relaxed about drug taking. If we look at reviews of the book, most reviewers judge that whereas taking opium on a regular basis was probably not a prudent thing to do, it wasn't as bad as heavy drinking. There was no notion really that it was addictive, at least in the medical sense. There may have been a layman's sense of addiction, a sense that, well, if you take this drug, you will need to take more over time and it will be hard to quit it. Yes. But it wasn't viewed as a medical condition, which therefore required medical intervention, potentially could become the basis for restricting the use and distribution of the drug to the medical sphere, which is, once again, the first step towards prohibition. And so we have a very valuable literary text reflecting the legislative, but also the legal, but also the cultural environment at the time in Europe on drugs. Somewhat different, of course, from drug cultures around at the time in other environments. I'm thinking of China, of course. And I'm also thinking of parts of the Muslim world, namely Egypt, on hashish, which had a much less good reputation at the time. But that's straying slightly off the subject. Now, for contemporaries, De Quincey had, a different significance. Contemporaries knew what they thought on drugs. It's not that people focused on drugs very much at the time. Opium was widely used in Britain. There's a reason to think it was widely used in the United States as well. It wasn't a particularly expensive product. It was accessible to all social classes. It was used as a painkiller. I wouldn't say drugs at the time or opium in particular were big topics, but to the extent they were topics, people thought of opium as something that non-Western people took, namely Chinese people who smoked opium, but also Turkish people who ate opium for recreational as well as medical purposes. The European opium, the British opium, the American opium as well, mostly came from Turkey. That's where it was grown. And De Quincey's book, Confessions of an English Opium Eater, shattered this notion. Suddenly you have someone who is English, who touts the fact that he's English in the very title of his book, and who's taking opium for quasi-medical and eventually recreational purposes. So in that sense, it was a landmark at the time.
At one point in the book, you talk about how in France, quote, established anxieties and the imagined threat seen through the prism of pre-existing dislikes made drugs seem dangerous, end quote. Does this model, in your view, apply to other places and times? And if so, how?
Yes, that's a very good question. So the funny thing about France around that time is, as I said, not many people used drugs, and probably because they were limited to medical channels. But there was this major, and some French observers did sarcastically observe on that, because there was this completely strange panic in France about opium and how it was going to corrupt France. And part of that came from colonial guilt mixed with a good dose of racism. France owned Indochina as a colony, so modern-day Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And in order to fund its presence there, had the brilliant idea of creating opium monopolies, encouraging people to smoke opium. But then the revenue would go to the colony, which funded the French imperial presence there. And so, but there was some criticism of that manner of doing things in France. There was also great fear that French colonial officers or merchants would start to smoke opium in Indochina and then come back and spread the vice back home. And mixed with that was the idea that the French situation was bad enough already because many French people were alcoholics, which was taking a terrible toll on the population and ultimately on France's ability to take revenge on the demographically more dynamic Germany and recover the lost provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, which the country had lost in the War of 1870-71. So with this whole background, is very peculiar. It has to do with Alsace-Lorraine, with Indochina, with anti-Oriental racism, fear of corruption by these subject races, and so on. It's this very weird and disturbing environment, giving rise to anxieties, which really reflected an extremely prosaic, simple reality, which was that extremely few people took drugs in France at the time. There's absolutely no reason to panic about anything. Now, it is something that I think we do see periodically everywhere. Just because you panic about drugs doesn't mean that there is a drug epidemic going on. And to take perhaps a non-Western example, for once, I'd look at Iran post 1979, which is not shaped by the same anxieties at all. Persia, later on, Persia as it was called at the time, had become a significant opium grower in the late 19th, early 20th century. It had become a big supply of smuggled opium in the interwar. And then in the 1950s, under the Shah, there had been a largely successful effort to stamp it out. And so a lot of eradication, the usual mixed program of some eradication, some medical measures, attempts to rehabilitate people who'd become dependent on opium at the time, leading to falling both drug production and use in Iran. It wasn't, the program wasn't completely successful, but the tentative evidence was that certainly Iranian opium production fell significantly in the 60s and 70s. and very likely also, although a lot of it was smuggled, so it's hard to tell, but very likely ostensibly the number of people who used drugs, partly because there was a registration program for people to enter into medical care and so on, if they were dependent users. And so we have some indication of the numbers, even if not everybody registered, and they are much lower than they had been in the early 50s. And then in 1979, you have the Iranian Revolution, followed by a hard-hitting clerical regime with strong prejudices against intoxicants. Now, of course, under Muslim law or Muslim religion, opiates are not specifically forbidden. It's only alcohol as an intoxicant that's forbidden, but because drugs are intoxicants, they tend to suffer by connection with alcohol. And the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime clamped extremely hard on drug use, hanging people from trees, and I mean, in very large numbers, punishing entire villages, and so on and so on. And actually, the policy backfired. Drug use began to skyrocket again in Iran, and it tended to be much harder drugs that people use, and still do. Iran remains a high drug use country. People don't use opium anymore. They tend to go for morphine or heroin.
You mentioned at one point in the book, this is a topic that I'm fascinated by, among many, how laws passed in America in the 1950s were, quote, a response not to a serious drug problem, but to the absence of one, end quote. What might this imply about the motivations and the goals of these laws?
Yes, well, the motivation, the goal was really to get to zero use or as close as possible to it. And the environment was that a number of the interwar treaties had temporarily been quite successful. I'm not sure we've got the time to get into the detail of that. But there had been extensive legislation through the League of Nations, new treaties regulating the drug trade, which had been successful at least in the late 20s and 30s for a variety of reasons, leading to reduced drug production, drug use. In the long run, it's very debatable how effective they were. Effectively, what they did was clamp down on the legal manufacture of a number of drugs, in particular morphine and heroin, cocaine as well, because that's where smuggled that originated at the time. And it took a while for the gangsters and the mafias of the world to figure out how to build their own labs. So in the meantime, you did see declining drug use around the world. There was also action in Southeast Asia, where the drug monopolies in the style of the French monopoly that I mentioned were slowly unwound, eventually terminated. And then the last big factor, of course, was the Second World War, which completely disrupted any sort of worldwide trafficking. And so in the post-war environment, the late 40s, early 50s, drug use around the world and in the United States, as in other places, was extremely low. And it looked as if drug prohibition was working extremely well, extremely nicely, thank you. And so let's add another layer, because punishment clearly appeared to be working, to finish the job. And the point is even more, I think, relevant when we think of the 1961 single convention, because these extremely harsh American penalties, which would insane the numbers of years of prison on a first offense for tiny detention amounts. Even the American Bar Association and Medical Association protested, said this is crazy, is abusive, you need to stop, although their appeals went unheard. But these penalties were reversed later on, some of them by Nixon, by the way. But the point, perhaps the wider point is that this treaty that remains, again, the keystone to international and domestic anti-narcotics legislation around the world, the 1961 UN-led single convention, was passed in the same environment when people thought they had triumphed over drugs and drug addiction. And so what we have is a system that's wonderfully adapted to an environment in which very few people take drugs. The question is whether it's still adapted to today's environment in which a very much larger number of people take drugs, or have become addicted or drug dependent or whatever, or abuse drugs, if you want to use that term.
Sort of following on to that political dimension, there is a school of thought that says when we understand the drug war's true goals, that is, for example, control of minorities and dissenters, militarization of law enforcement, access to non-state actors, the drug war can be seen as a success in promoting these larger geopolitical goals. And I'm curious about your view of this school of thought.
Okay, I'm a little bit puzzled. I'm not sure where that comes from, really.
I might say it's a bit of an American concoction. And this, I would say, this first came up in the 80s and 90s in America in the movement to reform drug laws. It also has some roots in the AIDS crisis in America in the 80s. So I think that's where it's coming from. It's really saying that the cover story, if you will, for the war on drugs is just that. It's a cover story. And actually, as politicians got more experience with this, they realized the political utility of the drug war. And they could not really be public about these goals. So that's a bit of the context for the question.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense. It still sounds a little bit fringe to me. It ignores the point that drug prohibition is much older than that. So it seems to me to chime a little bit with the notion that it was all started by the evil Nixon. By the way, on the evil Nixon, it's worth mentioning that actually his war on drugs involved a very large budget for healthcare, drug healthcare, rehabilitation, but also things such as what's called drug maintenance, which consists of giving alternative drugs to drug users, including a scheduled drug known as methadone. That was the initiative of Nixon's drug czar, Jerome Jaffe, who was a bold and progressive doctor, actually, not at all a crusty old drug warrior. And Nixon's healthcare budget for drugs was bigger than his suppression budget. You know, that tells you something. In fact, it was, if I'm not wrong, his administration was the last one to have a larger healthcare budget than a suppression budget in America. So, you know, there's all sorts of, I'm a bit worried about misinterpretation here. Drug warriors may be misguided, but my impression is that they are sincere. You know, also, obviously, if we take, then how do you explain that you have committed prohibitionists in a whole variety of other countries with completely different cultures and conditions? You know, I'm not going to even talk about a totalitarian country like China. But, you know, what about Buddhist Thailand? You know, strongly prohibitionist country, historically. In fact, their historians have come up with a 12th century Thai law against opium, because opium interfered with Buddhist meditation practice, essentially, ostensibly, and Buddhism underpinned Thai kingship. So, you know, I think looking at just the last 20 years, and of course there are very problematic and sometimes even disturbing racist connections, racist aspects to some of the drug laws and the war on drugs. I'm not denying that. But that's not the same thing as to say that's the real motive behind drug prohibition.
That's fair. At one point in the book, you describe drugs as attractive to intelligence agencies. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the ways in which that works and the ways in which drugs and perhaps drug trafficking are attractive to intelligence agencies. What's the connection there?
Okay, well, that's another slightly conspiracy theory area, but it is interesting, and it is supported by history for sure. There is a very courageous and serious American historian whose name I'm looking for, Alfred McCoy, who's written, sometimes even at personal risk, but certainly who's undertaking huge research and gone through a huge amount of material on the CIA involvement in Southeast Asian drug, the Southeast Asian drug trades and drug trafficking. But certainly the CIA has not been the only agency that's been more or less directly tied to drug trafficking. In fact, the CIA has been rather less directly tied to drug trafficking, because they, the CIA, even if you follow McCoy, have provided certain transport facilities to allies who were funding guerrilla war efforts based on opium, but they were never involved in the traffic themselves. They, you know, they may have closed their eyes on it when it was convenient, but they didn't actually sell drugs themselves. Unlike the French Secret Service, the SDECE, which very clearly was a partner in the French Connection. You've heard of the French Connection? Yes, those were people, were French gangsters, mostly Corsican gangsters, were buying opium in Turkey, refining it in southern France, and shipping the heroin to the United States and other American countries. And we find a lot of members, a lot of gangsters in the French Connection who were SDECE agents. And one of them was arrested and said, well, I have heroin, but that's, you know, I was instructed by the agency to do that. And it was a bit bad. Eventually, the French state is clamped down because it just became too embarrassing. And of course, the other spy agency has been the Pakistani ISI, which was knee-deep in the Afghan and Pakistani, but then later Afghan heroin trade. If we look at more conceptual reasons why we might see this, I mean, apart from the, so it's exciting from a conspiracy theory point of view, but are there reasons that make that likely to happen? And I can think of three. One is, first of all, drug dealers, international drug dealers, will typically be violent men, or at least men who like adventure and risk, who live in the shade, and you could see the same thing, say the same thing as spies. And so here's the, you know, the people from the SDCE would be a good example. The second factor making drugs an interesting tool in spycraft is that they have a high value per weight. They're very portable. They can be sold pretty much anywhere for a high price, and so they're a great source of extra budgetary funds. Yes, and they were, so the cocaine trade was, became somehow embroiled in the Iran-Contra affair. This is not an illustration of this sort of thing at work. And the third reason, in my opinion, is that you typically see drugs grown and trafficked, not always, but often in failed states or states faced with a breakdown in a significant breakdown in state authority. Examples would be Afghanistan, of course, for the last 30 years, but also Colombia, which faced less so now, but for 20 years faced an extremely tough insurgency. But these states also happen to be states in which intelligence agencies are more likely to intervene, precisely because they are failed states or states potentially on the way to failure.
Along the lines of your second explanation for that, I wanted to follow up with this question. Most Americans, if you were to ask them, would say that enormous sums of money have been expended on the drug war. And you assert in the book that the deck is and has been stacked against enforcement and presumably these high level of spent, this high level of spending. So how would you reconcile these two concepts?
That's a very good point. They are large sums. But to be successful, they would probably require to be, they probably need to be far larger by a significant multiple. And so if we can talk numbers, so if we look at the quarter century of the spectacular phase of the war on drugs abroad. So this is when Pablo Escobar was shut down. There were numerous operations in South America and so on and so on. The post-Nixonian part of the war on drugs, 1982-2004. The budget for foreign drug suppression, the American budget for foreign drug suppression, was $45 billion. That's about $2 billion annually, which, you know, probably is a large sum of money. Except that in the year 2000, estimates are that the wholesale value of drugs sold worldwide, I'm not talking about the retail value, the wholesale, because the retail is not strictly comparable because here you have street prices and so on, domestic enforcement, so on, was $94 billion per year. Per year. So we're talking 50 times what America was spending on drug suppression abroad. So, of course, I realize that other states were involved, notably Latin American states, but actually the by far the biggest budget was the American budget. So here we have a problem of means. You know, in war, money matters. And if you're spending 2% of the enemy is spending, you're not going to win, are you? So if we look at another set of numbers, by another measure, I have this number that measures the cost of drug enforcement worldwide. So this includes policing, this includes prisons and so on, incarceration worldwide. And that's $100 billion per year. This time, it's an annual figure. Now, that's today, not to the year 2000, or roughly today, a few years back, of course, but today. The size of the worldwide street value market, which was, you know, this is how much the opposition is making versus how much, you know, the states around the world are spending, is at the very least $400 billion and probably more in the round of, probably more in the ballpark of $500 billion. So once again, here again, even if we count all the costs of the maintaining these people in prison, police forces, arrests, judicial systems, and foreign drug suppression, the lot, you're only, in inverted commas, at $100 billion, whereas they've got $500 billion. So it's not enough. If your goal is to, you know, win the war on drugs, if you think it's winnable and you're going to win it, you need to spend more, much more. You need to spend more than the opposition. Maybe $1 trillion would be a good number.
Right.
And of course, I'm being facetious. Yes, I'm being provocative for the sake of it. But this is what I meant.
Right. And even then, this is a separate topic, but even then, that level of spending would not guarantee a significantly different result. But that's a different question. But I want to sort of follow up because you've talked about supply, focusing on sources of supply. And my question is a bit of a hypothetical one. Do you believe that a focus on demand reduction would have been or could be more successful than a supply side focus of the drug war? Now, you could say that, well, that's what Nixon was trying to some degree in 1971 with methadone maintenance and similar programs. And do you believe that an extended focus on demand reduction, which would also imply much greater availability of treatment, would have been or could be more successful than the supply side focus that we have seen?
All right, there's a lot to unpick there. There actually is quite a lot being spent on demand reduction around the world, including the United States. It's true that, to my knowledge, the federal budget is bigger on suppression. But it's not as though nothing is being spent on demand reduction. What I'm pausing slightly is there's a little bit of jargon involved here. Because people talk about demand reduction and they talk about harm reduction, which are two different things. And demand reduction actually is a prohibitionist term. So it's the term favored by the big UN agencies, for example, who advise and run on advise on the anti-narcotics on anti-narcotics laws and systems and actions and programs, there is a very large agency named UNODC based in Vienna that does specifically that. And they are quite big on harm reduction, which in the jargon means dissuading people from taking drugs, whether through information campaigns or through directing them towards rehab, which goes alongside suppression as such. Then you have harm reduction, which is connected but takes a somewhat different view in the sense that it is more pessimistic as to the chances of persuading a large number of people not to take drugs in the first place. And so this is where maintenance comes in. It's like, well, folks, information campaigns don't work because they just don't listen. Or maybe they work, but they only go so far, and drug using population is still rising. And so we need to reduce harm, meaning we need to reduce all the harmful effects really of drug prohibition. So it's needle exchange programs. It's perhaps supervised injection rooms. It's providing alternative drugs that are less dangerous than heroin or fentanyl, such as methadone, to people, but providing them not with the aim of rehab, but providing potentially as something permanent or to be taken for a very long period of time. I'm not sure really answering your question. More demand reduction. I think a lot is being done in demand reduction already. More harm reduction. Yes, I believe that would be. It's working in a lot of countries. And it's worth doing more, because what else are you going to do? Just drug use keeps expanding in a number of countries, and in the U.S., obviously. And it's become extremely dramatic in the U.S., and it's a cause of dreadful mortality. American life expectation is now something like 4 years lower than the typical European country. And out of that, 3 years are due to opioids. It's completely crazy. I mean, America is the most advanced country on earth, or pretty close. It has no business having a life expectancy 4 years behind the average European country. It's terrible. And I believe harm reduction would make a big difference.
I want to close with a question about the international drug control regime. Given your emphasis on that and its clear importance in the war on drugs, how do you see this regime evolving in the next 5, 10, 15 years? We as historians do not like to predict, I know, but I'm curious about your thoughts about how you see this regime evolving. You talked about the last decade being a serious challenge to this regime, and I wonder what you might anticipate going forward.
That's a great concluding question. I'd say there is a threefold challenge right now to the anti-narcotics global order, and by extension, obviously, domestic drug laws. The first is marijuana legalization in two countries, Uruguay and Canada, and of course also in a number of American states, with perhaps under the Biden administration, federal legalization. We shall see. But even if we don't see, we already have, with the legalization of marijuana, a significant challenge to the international anti-narcotics order, because it just isn't compatible with the drug treaties. And Canada and Uruguay are simply in violation of the treaties. There's no way around it. Germany, by the way, may well legalize. The Scholz government has said it that it would legalize marijuana. If it does so, you could see a number of European countries following. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge comes in the form of what are known as NPS, which are new psychoactive substances, and they're effectively synthetic substitutes to the established drugs. The problem with them from the perspective of the drug laws and drug scheduling is that they change constantly. And so it's very difficult to add them to the schedules and therefore keep sweeping them under drug legislation. The third challenge is that a number of Latin American statesmen have specifically said that they are fed up with the war on drugs. Whether in Mexico, whether in Uruguay, and more recently, the newly elected president of Colombia have said that there's simply too much violence involved. It does not work for these countries, which are not even significant users, whose population is not even significant users of cocaine. Cocaine use is not negligible in Latin America, but it's much lower than in the USA. And so they are questioning the war on drugs and the anti-narcotics order as it's being run. I'm skeptical that we will see, nevertheless, any reform to the drug treaties. There's just too much resistance. It's too hard. It's just too hard. Many countries around the world are dead opposed to any sort of change. A number of Asian countries, for example. Not even mentioning the complicated American politics on the topic. What we might see, however, what we're already seeing to some degree, is a partial creeping hollowing out of the international drug order through marijuana legalizations, and we will see more such episodes. New Zealand narrowly voted against, I think it was last year or the year before, but we will see more legalizations. We might see it in Jamaica, some, or perhaps South Africa, in some non-European, or if we like, non-Western countries. The NPS remain a significant challenge. I'm not sure the Latin American countries will move the marker so much at forums such as the UN assemblies or even in the direct relation with the United States, but they might start dragging their feet in practical terms. So that would be my prediction, for what it's worth.
Well, I think it's worth a lot. And
thank
Pierre,
you.
I'd like to thank you for being here today. And I'd like to thank you for a book that helps us understand the drug war's many dimensions. I want to thank as well our listeners on the New Books Network. Take care, and we will talk again soon.